Morning. We're going to call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, February 23rd, 2005. It's now 8:38 a.m. In attendance, we have Senator French, Senator Huggins, myself, Senator Seekins. Senator Guest online? Senator Guest is online with us. Good morning, Gretchen. Can you hear us? We can hear you. We're going to start out this morning with Senate Bill 109. Senator Wilken is the sponsor. Senator Wilken, welcome to the Judiciary Committee this morning. And if you know the drill, if you'll put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Wilken, and I have the privilege of representing Senate District E, as in excellent, in Fairbanks. And I thank you and the committee members for hearing Senate Bill 109 this morning. Senate Bill 109 is modeled after a bill that was put in place by Senator Donnelly back in 1999, and we've all driven through construction zones and had the temptations to speed as people were working along the road. Senator Donnelly followed other states and put in place a double fine in construction zones. This takes this a step further and recognizes that we would like to have drivers slow down in our school zones also. Last year we had over 1,000, almost 1,100 school zone violations in our schools across the state, according to the troopers. That could or should raise concern. This bill asks that, puts in place that if a school zone is lighted with flashing lights, and that would be contemplated to be during school hours or bracketed school hours, that the double fines are in existence. It doesn't mandate school districts to do it. It doesn't mandate DOT to do it. If the school district would have a particular school that they would like to have lit, and it's their road, it's their responsibility, they would take on the responsibility of the cost to have that installed. If it's on DOT roads, DOT would put that into their capital improvements and do those as necessary. So it's fairly straightforward. It has been effective with the construction zones. I think it'd be every bit as effective in school zones, particularly in my neck of the woods, where we have dark and many times ice fog that makes it particularly dangerous for kids that are crossing and crossing guards that are trying to get kids across the road. So with that, it just underscores the importance of being careful in our many school zones across the state. And with that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. We do have a couple of folks online, I believe. Fellow by the name of Bob Myers. Bob is a longtime crossing guard in Fairbanks, and Senator Seekins, you know where Danby, and Senator Terrio, you know where Danby Road is. It's probably not the best road you would put a middle school and a grade school on, but location-wise, it's very good because it's across the street from one of the 801 military housing projects, which means there's a great deal of military kids that cross that road every day to those two schools. But it's a curvy road that's a connector between two main roads, and is probably the poster child for this type of legislation. Danby Road, as Mr. Myers will testify, installed the school district, or DLT, excuse me, installed flashing lights, and he saw the difference. When the lights went up, he, for one, along with others, would like to see an increased emphasis on speeding in school zones, and this bill does that by doubling the fines. Also, Lieutenant Sharp is with us from the troopers. Any questions that you may have? And with that, I'm available for questions and consideration of Senate Bill 109. Thank you.
Senator Huggins.
Senator Wilken, I agree with your bill here for the most part. I guess the one thing that came to mind, though, was buses. When buses are stopped and that whole proposition, I mean, that's sort of an extension of the school grounds. Did you think about that? The building, in the words, a bus stopped and somebody runs through the stop of the bus. I'm not trying to complicate the bill. I just wondered if you'd considered that.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, didn't contemplate buses. My knowledge, having some years ago been stopped for not stopping for a red light on time for a school bus, the wrath of hell came down upon me. So I guess I followed. I remember that, and that didn't want to do anything because I think that's at least my personal experience. It was enough of a slap that I remember it, and perhaps Lieutenant Sharp can help with that as he talks to us. But it doesn't contemplate buses because I think that's well taken care of in existing statute.
Yeah. But my other, just based on personal experience, is that unfortunately, sometimes during Christmas periods or spring breaks, the lights in some of those school zones remain on, which creates a bad habit of, we know the kids aren't there and people sort of disregard them. But that doesn't have anything to do with your bill, but does create bad habits for drivers because they disregard it and drive on because there aren't any kids present. Just a comment.
Other questions? Senator French?
I'm puzzled by a paragraph I'm just now reading in one of the fiscal notes. It's the fiscal note from the state troopers. There's one from criminal, one from public defenders, and one from state troopers. And the paragraph I'm puzzled about says, modification of the current bail schedule would have to occur since speeding in a school zone already has enhanced penalties. If this bill were to become law and the current bail amount was not modified, the penalties would be so burdensome as to become impractical. With the doubling of the penalties for speeding in the school zone and downward modification of the bail schedule, the penalty would still be greater than what currently exists. Do you know what they're after there?
Through the chair, Senator French, I don't, and I read this week, received this fiscal note, as you can see, late yesterday afternoon, and I don't know what that sentence starting with "if this bill" means. And so we'll have to get some help on that. And Marty and I talked this morning, we just don't understand it other than this bill doesn't contemplate increasing the bail amount. So
it's the fine.
It's the fine. It's mm-hmm. the fine itself that doubles. And so maybe that's what they're talking about, that we wouldn't, we're not doubling the bail here. We're only doubling the fine. That's the only thing we can think of when we talk this morning. So we'll chase that because I don't understand it either. It's a good question.
I see that Lieutenant Sharp's name is on that list, and I believe Lieutenant Sharp is online. Lieutenant Sharp, this is Chairman Seekins. Can you explain that paragraph for us?
Yes, Chairman. I guess that what we were looking at is if we doubled the bail amount for like 20 miles or over, the speed limit is currently $16 per mile per hour penalty presently for school zone. If we were to double that, then it could get quite burdensome for pay that type of fine for.
That's for 40 miles over?
20 miles an hour over.
Okay, for 20 miles an hour over.
Right. 3 to 9 miles per hour is $12 per mile per hour presently.
So that would go to 24.
Right. 10 to 19 miles per hour over presently, the bail is $14 per mile per hour. And if you're 20 miles per hour or over, current is $16 per mile per hour bail.
So it gets very expensive for someone to do that.
If it was a double bail amount, yes.
Senator French?
Lieutenant, maybe you could just explain for everybody that's listening the difference between the bail amount and the fine amount and how those two work, just to kind of get us off on the right foot for understanding this.
If we'll go with the lowest level there, at 3 miles over, you're going to get $12 per mile per hour.
But I think what Senator French is saying is, what's the difference between bail and penalty and fine?
The penalty would be set at 12 times 3, and then you would have to double that fine, I guess. I think I kind of misunderstood when I wrote the physical note. It sounds like that actually we're not increasing the bail amount. We're only he's doubling the fine. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That's correct.
Then we would just double that amount.
Okay.
I'm not sure my understanding got any greater. Maybe just kind of walk us through it, just like we didn't know anything about this. When you stop someone for speeding in a school zone, what is the fine amount represent, and what does the bail amount represent?
The fine amount is based on the bail. For 3 miles over, you're going to pay the $35 is going to be your fine. Based on your speed over the limit. And now, according to what you guys are telling me, because we were figuring that we were going to be doubling the bail, which would then have made it $24 per mile per hour for 3 miles over, which would have been burdensome, of course. But if not, now we'd be talking that somebody would be paying a $70 fine if we double that fine. So the difference is the bail is $12 per mile per hour over the speed limit. The fine is the total, which in the case of a 3 miles per hour over, $35.
Okay. Senator French, answer your question.
Just one more question. Is the bail amount what you post if you intend to contest the ticket?
Yes.
And the fine amount is what you eventually pay if you're found guilty.
That's correct.
Thank you.
I have a question, Senator, Lieutenant Sharp, and maybe you can't answer this. But when I take a look at the citation list that's been supplied to us by the sponsor, I see that the state troopers have issued a total of 26. Anchorage Police Department, 1,029. And the next highest is the Fairbanks Police Department at 14. Why, do you have any idea why the Anchorage Police Department has such a disproportionate number of citations versus the rest of the state?
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't have an answer for why the Anchorage Police Department has got such high numbers. However, they may have been involved in some specific efforts to deter school zone violations.
I seem to recall that in Anchorage that Minnesota Drive goes right past West High School
in Roaming.
And is that a school zone? And is that kind of, I wonder if that's a hotbed of where they get people, because nobody pays attention to it being a school zone. It's a major thoroughfare. And I wonder if that's where you can pick up your quota. Senator French?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I live in that district. I represent that district, and I've dropped my son off at Roaming for 2 years in a row, and now he goes to West. It's really Roaming that fronts on Minnesota. West is kind of off.
Right.
But it's physically there, but the access is to Roaming. And it's well posted with flashing lights, but it is rush hour. And so I think a lot of folks, and they're typically police posted there as well, keeping an eye out. So I don't doubt that you get a large number of tickets written in that area.
Senator Hoggins?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Wilkins, presently when you go, when you hit a work zone prior to, you get the warnings of double fine area. Would that same be included for school zones?
The bill doesn't require a sign that says double fines in school zones. The law in the work zones does require at the beginning of the section, at the end of the section, a beginning and end of double fines. This does not. This requires that the flashing lights would be the determinant.
But if the flashing lights aren't there, the bill does not apply to the zone? Okay.
The lights would have to be active in order for it to be a double fine zone.
Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to go back on the the fines issue and the, what was it called? What's the other term?
Bail.
Bail. you're really talking about the same dollar amount. You're talking about the same computation. It's just when the trooper issues you the ticket, is it bail? If you determine not to contest it, then you turn the bail into your fine. Is that the way that works?
I didn't do a lot of tickets. I did mostly misdemeanors, but the trooper, yeah.
Am I still online?
Yes.
To the chair, that is correct. When we determine the bail amount, that is then would result in your fine amount, and we're basing the bail amount on your per mile an hour over related to those figures I gave you.
And does the fine, the ultimate ultimate fine, always match the bail? It's always the same number?
If someone contests the citation and it goes to court, the judge can, in their efforts to reduce a fine, they cannot penalize anyone more than the maximum bail, but they can reduce it if they seem that they felt it was necessary to do so.
Okay. Thank you.
Let me ask you, Senator Wilkin, I'm just trying to think of, you know, in Fairbanks, we don't have any main thoroughfares that go right into school zones. Try to think of along Minnesota Drive there. There have been times when I've been driving along there and I didn't see that blinking light myself because there's a truck between me and the light on the side of the road. No excuse under the law that I didn't see the blinking yellow light. Is there any requirement that you know of when there is a blinking yellow light that it be easily visible from all lanes of traffic?
Not that I'm aware of, other than a DOT representative is here, but DOT has certain specs that they have a capital, a STIP project of a little over $1.5 million. For school zone upgrades, and in that appears from their paperwork that they have certain specifications that they build these to, and they have some nomenclature in here that those specs must contemplate that they have to be visible in a certain amount of height and width and that type of thing. DOT could probably follow up on that, but yeah, has to be some sort of a specification.
I know when you're in a couple of lanes of traffic, it's rush hour, and you don't see a sign that's 6 feet high along or 10 feet high along the side of the road, you could very easily get in trouble. That's the only reason I'm asking that question. I will ask that of the DOT representative. Senator Terrio?
Is this fine subject to the surcharge that funds the police officer's training fund?
Lieutenant Sharp, through the chair, yes, it is.
And could you go over that computation? How's that figured? So how much, give me an example of a ticket that, you know, ultimately is paid as a fine, and then what's the multiplier, how is the surcharge figured?
The surcharge, through the chair, the surcharge for that offense would be $10 for any one of the variations of the penalty. Because it's an infraction, it's a $10 surcharge.
Okay. Thank you.
To each offense.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Hello?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator, yes, may I ask a question?
Sure, go ahead.
Senator Wilkin, can you explain a little bit more why you're saying that it has to have flashing yellows? The yellow lights. I know most of the elementary schools in my district actually don't have flashing yellows because they're not on a main road. Is there a reason why you put that in the definition versus just signage?
Why there would be flashing lights as opposed to, say, just to, as it is today, a 20 mile an hour school zone sign?
Yes.
The problem we had with the bill last year was that we became concerned about when the zone was active and when it was not active. In other words, is it active at 7 o'clock at night when it's posted as a 20-mile-per-hour school zone? And to have a set of lights that clearly identifies that this is what amounts to a major infraction seemed to give more import to what we were trying to do, and it clearly defines when the double fine is in existence.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Seeing none, do we have someone? Who would you like to be next, Senator?
I'd like to hear from Bob Meyer, perhaps as a person that deals with this issue on a regular basis.
Bob, you're there online from Fairbanks. Can you hear us?
I can hear you, yes.
Okay. Bob, Senator Wilkins indicated that you may have some relevant testimony for us this morning. If you'll put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear that.
I will do that. Thank you. I want to wish a good morning to everybody. And my name is Bob Myers, and I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 109. I'm a father, a grandfather, foster parent, and I'm also an employee of the Fairbanks North Star School District as an elementary day custodian. This is my sixth year at Ann Wien Elementary School, which is located on Danby Street in Fairbanks. One of my morning duties is as a crossing guard on Danby. We have military housing across Danby, and we have two intersections that feed the military students to Ann Wien and Randy Smith Middle School. Now, due to funding, we only have one crossing guard from Laidlaw Transportation, and Mrs. Campbell, my principal, has asked me to handle the other crossing guard. I do that in the mornings, but my shift is over prior to the afternoon crossing time, and so those kids cross unattended after 3 o'clock. I've been doing this for about 5 years. In this 5 years, I've seen a lot of different things at this intersection. The speed limit on Danby is normally 40 miles an hour, but it reduces to 20 during crossing hours. And speeding is a daily occurrence. And I saw probably three or four cars that were going more than just, you know, a handful of miles over this morning. I had a couple that were clipping along pretty fast this morning. I heard in your numbers that Fairbanks did 14 tickets, and I think realistically, if the police were manning my intersection, they could do 14 at my intersection alone. During the peak time for my students to cross is also the peak time for the morning rush hour. And some of the experiences I've encountered include cars running my stop sign with students in the crosswalk. I had the first week back from Christmas break this year, we had a lot of ice fog. Senator Wilkins mentioned that we get the ice fog. And I had four run my stop sign in that week, two of them on the same day. One of which, while I had students in the crosswalk, I wasn't just beginning to go out in the crosswalk. I was already there, and the students were already there. Last year, I had a car come sliding at me sideways. He wasn't paying attention. I had already had cars stopped, and I heard the sound of sliding tires on the snow and gravel. As I looked up, sun coming sliding at me sideways. And I literally ran, and he ended up on the cross street facing the way he had come from. In the 5 years that I've had, that I've handled this crossing, I've had a lot of time to think of ways to make our kids safer. And some of the things that I've tried, I've made banners, and I parked my truck along the shoulder of the road. I put the banners on the hood on the front end and the back end as reminders to slow down. That's been somewhat effective. I've written letters to the editor. I've called into talk radio. I've used my cell phone to call the company phone number on commercial vehicles, and I've spoken to supervisors. I've called Laidlaw, our bus company, when buses are flying through there. I've also called the Fairbanks police a number of times, and when I call quite frequently, then I, for a short period of time, I tend to get better coverage, and quite often there's a number of tickets written during that time. These things have all helped some, but not enough in my opinion. The Fairbanks police run on a limited budget, and so their coverage is not as much as I would like it to be, but that's kind of the fact of life. Two summers ago, while I was traveling the highways of Alaska, I encountered the construction zones, and I saw the double fine signage, and I thought at that time, why can't we protect our kids that way? And so that's why I brought this up to Senator Wilkins a year ago, and he attempted to get this through last year, and are again. I want to thank Senator Wilkins for sponsoring this bill and working with me, and like he mentioned a moment ago, he introduced a similar bill last year, and it needs a little bit of work, and so here we are again. I think we cannot do too much to protect our kids, and you know, with just the number of tickets that you indicated, those aren't. If you could count every infraction, whether they were caught or not, you could probably multiply that number several times. And I know we've had a lot of children injured and killed over the years. The first time I contacted Senator Wilkins' office in October of 2003 to talk about this, his office staff told me that just the day before, a child riding their bicycle to school in Juneau had been hit and killed. I believe we need to protect our children, and I think we need to, you know, this is just one step. I think there's, you know, some other measures down the road maybe, but this is a good beginning. I want to thank you, and if anybody has any questions, I'm willing to take those.
Mr. Myers, is there a flashing yellow light there on Danby Road?
There are. Nearly the full length of Danby is school zone, and I think there's three lights, one at the beginning, one in the middle, one at the end, that are visible from going each direction.
Okay.
And it is on a curve, as Senator Wilkins indicated, and I think in the long run, you know, more signage and lights could be done, but I think this measure will be a good start.
Okay. Questions for Ms. Meyer? Do you have any questions, Senator Guest?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Meyer.
Thank you.
Senator Wilkin.
Just might, again, thank you for your consideration. I just might refer you to this page. That should this bill pass the legislature, it would be effective immediately in 95 zones across the state. So it would have an immediate impact. And then we'll continue to work on the others. But, it is something that would heighten the awareness of speeding in school zones almost immediately. So with that, thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Wilson, do you have a comment on the flashing yellow light standard? Could you come up and maybe put yourself on the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Nona Wilson. I'm the legislative liaison from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, here to answer some questions you might have on SB 109. I'm willing to take any questions you might have.
Anything on flashing, the flashing yellow light standard as far as visibility is concerned?
Correct. We have what's called the Manual for Uniform Traffic Control Devices, and if you recall, we spoke about that on a previous bill with the buckle up signs, and basically what that revolves around, for those of you on the Transportation Committee. We spoke about that, and what DOT focuses on is being consistent with where we place signs, and that's all due to driver expectation. That's a safety measure. We place the flashing yellow signs outside of the lane. If you were driving down Minnesota on the northbound approach, you would see the flashing light on the right-hand side of the road. If you were southbound on Minnesota in front of Rogue Meg, you would see that on the right side as well. Currently, our standard is two installations, one on the one approach and the other sign on the right side of the road on the second approach, which would be north or south or east or west. Depending on the length of the school zone, how far you place those apart, you might have a third, say for instance on a curve, just to remind people that they're still in a school zone, because I think sometimes people get into the 20 mile an hour zone and assume that if you can't see students, you're probably out of it. And so sometimes we place another sign or blinking sign in there just to remind people that they still need to be driving 20 miles an hour or less. The criteria for placing signs is a little bit complicated. I have a page out of the Alaska Traffic Manual Supplement, but it's difficult to read and hard to explain. But basically what it comes down to is the speed of traffic in the area, the volume of traffic, and also the age of the students. In a lot of the school zones where you have kindergarten through sixth grade, you're going to see a lot more safety and traffic control devices in those areas. High schools, depending on the area, most of the time don't have as much hardware up, just because those students are usually driving their own vehicle or getting to school by some other method, or it's just their age group where we don't think that placing that much signage up is really appropriate. Another reason why we would usually have two signs, one on each approach for a school, is the cost is high to install those signs. It's about, for a pair, it's $70,000. And I could explain why, but there's basically the design installation, the pole that it's on, the load center, which is the power cell that powers it, which is usually set off back somewhere on the side of the road. That's a little, basically a power cell to keep those lights blinking. It's also got a conduit in it. It tells that light when to go on and off. It's programmed, things like that. So we also try and keep it to two approaches just to keep that cost down as well. So,
are you you're familiar with the Minnesota?
Yes. Yeah, I grew up in Anchorage.
So, you know, I've driven down that road many times, and I know that that light's on, and there's not a single person going 20 miles an hour. And you, in French, you say your son goes to school there, and was in that junior high school. So, I guess, in all fairness, well, that's a target-rich environment right there.
Sure.
Because there are many times when I've gone down that road and not seen that sign because it's, my visibility has been blocked to the side. And I'm wondering if, you know, when we're going to be very severe on fines on this situation, that we don't have an affirmative responsibility to make sure that whatever sign is posted is visible to all lanes of traffic under the circumstances that vehicles would travel down that road. Because, man, I don't know where the fine money goes, but if I was the city of Anchorage and it doubles, I'm going to just have a whole 24-hour-a-day
vigil
on Minnesota Drive. And
goes to the general fund.
Yeah, does it? But it would be, to me, it would be a, that's about the most target-rich environment I've ever seen in my life for something like this, and I could never quite figure out, maybe Senator French can tell me, why that that was a school zone on that particular road if there wasn't some other means of being able to protect is there foot traffic that walks across it?
There's hundreds of apartments on the right-hand side of the road, and the school is on the left-hand side of the road going downtown.
Right.
And so there's lots of kids that are coming across that road to get to Roaming.
Yeah, and I don't know. See, I've never been there when I saw kids there, because it was generally when they were in class and I was zipping along.
And I think the lights only flash in the morning from, 7 a.m. till 9 a.m., and then again in the afternoon from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m.
But so I'm just wondering, if, and I'm not trying to make the bill complicated because I agree with the premise. I'm wondering if that definition ought to say, that there's a school zone means and are identified by flashing yellow lights that are clearly visible from all lanes of traffic by signs, by flashing yellow lights and signs that are clearly visible to all from.
Also, if I may, Senator Seekins, if you remember on the northbound coming up Minnesota, there's also a bridge where students are crossing. So the question is, are you going to be marking student crossings as well? For instance, on North Douglas, you come off the bridge right here, you make that left turn. Mm-hmm. There's no school there, but there's a flashing, there's a pair of flashing lights there where it's where students are crossing what we call at grade, which is right there on the street with everyone else. The alternative to adding more for DOT's part for signage instead of paying $70,000 or $45,000 for an extra sign, we also have measures that we could take to increase school visibility, like advanced warning signs. Some have the pedestrian signs across where the traffic signal's hang, where it's a yellow triangle and it flashes that says this is a student crossing, a stop sign or stop control environment. There's some other options. Another option would be to say you're entering a double flying zone. Can't say we didn't warn you.
I agree. I don't know, would the sponsor have any problem with just expanding that to make sure that we do say that these signs and yellow flashing lights need to be clearly visible from all lanes of traffic? I know there's a standard, but I would have been, if they would have been waiting for me, I'd have been nailed there a few times. Simply because of that. I don't know, Senator Wilkin, any comment?
I think it's implied that when you put flashing lights up and signs, that part of the spec is that they be visible from all lanes of traffic, and I don't think you would ever be able to ensure that there isn't a truck or something distracts you.
I understand that.
If it helps the bill, I have no problem with it. It sort of does a foot stomp to what we're trying to do.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Wilkins and Nona, does this cover the school parking lot? Is it? In my estimation, if you really want to have some fun, go to the school parking lot where most students walk, and you want to write some. You can write 14 in one afternoon without any problem. If the most hazardous place in the school is in the school parking lot. I think we're on the right track on this one potentially, but there is Clint Eastwood territory.
You speak from experience?
Yes, having observed.
Well, Senator Taylor.
I have just another question for the lieutenant. So I just want to check the extra fine or surcharge that's tacked on that goes to the Police Standards Council. That won't be impacted by this, because they're currently, if you get a ticket, we're talking about doubling the fine, but you pay a flat fee per ticket, right? So the amount of money that's generated for that fund is not going to go up by action on this bill, is it?
Through the chair, Mr. Terrio, that's correct. It's $10 per fine no matter what. If it's 3 miles an hour over, you pay the $10 surcharge. If it's 10 miles per hour over, it's simply a $10 surcharge. If it's 20 miles per hour, it's still a $10 surcharge. And I went ahead and calculated out here. committee, based on a three mile per hour over, presently the fine would be $45 with the that includes the $10 surcharge. At 10 miles per hour, presently, you're looking at $150, which also includes the $10 surcharge. 20 miles per hour, presently, it's $230 with the and that includes the $10 surcharge. So the difference would be under this bill that it would become for 3 miles an hour over the speed limit would be an $80 fine, which includes that $10 surcharge. At 10 miles per hour, it would be a $290 fine, which includes the $10 surcharge. And at 20 miles per hour over, it would be a $450 fine, and that also includes that $10 surcharge.
Senator,
can you tell me, 3 miles an hour over the speed limit, are you usually really ticketing for 3 miles an hour over, or do you usually have a break point that's got to at least be five?
It would depend on a lot of different circumstances involved, but generally I would say probably not.
Okay. And do you have any history with the traffic courts? When you get down to those smaller numbers, do the judges routinely toss those out because it's too close of a call, it could be equipment error? Or
generally, you don't see too many citations issued for just simply 3 miles per hour over the speed limit. So that hasn't necessarily been an issue that I'm aware of on that one. What I'm thinking about is if there was children present, somebody had a near miss, something like that, and we had a speed over the amount that could be charged, and judges generally don't have a problem. Usually people either pay the bail, and if they do contest, you know, the judge generally looks at the circumstances and is reasonable.
And can you tell me, do you have any idea the amount of money that is paid on a yearly basis on those surcharges that go to that the standards training fund?
Well, it would take me a second to come up with a total based on the figures that we supplied for 2004, but it appears as though we had 1,000.
I was asking for the total fines that are paid to the fund, not just from school crossings, but
I do not have that number. I can perhaps give you something.
Well, actually, if you would call that information to my office, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Senator Wilkin.
Could I offer a conceptual amendment to take care of perhaps your concerns? Page 2, line 2, after the word area, insert the word clearly. Read an area clearly defined. After the word lights, page 2, line 2, insert the six words visible from all lanes of traffic. So it would read lights visible from all lanes of traffic. And then line 3 would continue on as written. So the sentence would read school zone means an area clearly identified by flashing yellow lights visible from all lanes of traffic and by signs as being near a school.
Chair will advance that as a conceptual amendment or an amendment. Amendment number 1. Is there objection? Hearing none, we'll adopt it as amendment number 1. Is there any further public testimony on the bill? No one here in Juneau, no one else online that I see.
Senator Seekins?
Yes.
This is Bob Myers in Fairbanks. I would like to address the topic of the signage. I think one of the things that's made the construction zones so effective is the signage warning that the double fine is in place. And I would hope that we would be able to do that in this case as well with the school crossings.
I think that this bill goes next to finance, if I'm not correct. And that would finance would need to take a look at that as a possible fiscal impact. So, Senator Wilkin, I imagine your finance committee will look at that.
Yes, we will.
Senator Terrio?
And I would imagine that would trigger a fiscal note from the department or somebody. And then, Senator Wilkin, I think you mentioned something about immediately this would go into place immediately, and Alaskans would know they have to be more careful in these zones. But I don't know how Alaskans are really going to know that. If you get a ticket, you're going to know because your fine is going to be a whopper. But unlike the construction zones where there's signage that says you're entering a double fine zone, unless there's going to be some kind of ad campaign, I'm going to drive by, the lights are blinking, and I don't know if there's been any change. There might be a story in the paper once on passage or something, but I don't know exactly how we get so that the general public knows.
Senator Terrio, there's also the Alaska Highway Safety Office through DOT that does all kinds of ad campaigns for buckle up, don't drink and drive. That might also be an option with their budget to do an ad campaign, maybe some radio commercials and TV as well. It's an option.
Well, it seemed like that we'd need to make some kind of effort to let people know that there's been a change in the status of the law as well.
Agree with that. That's a good point. So for any other further public testimony? Hearing none, public testimony is closed. Discussion by the members? Senator Guest, any discussion or questions?
No, thank you.
Anyone else? Senator Huggins?
Mr. Chair, just one note. Fairbanks, in this case, 14 tickets for this kind of offense. Anchorage, 1,400, as I recall. It appears to me that one of the elements here is not the amount of the fine, which is a deterrent, obviously, but it's the sort of the effort of the enforcement guys. And I'm not saying they're good or bad. It just appears to be a different level of effort and emphasis. And I might suggest that, quite frankly, if people are briefed on their duty rotational schedule before they go out, that might do as much as doubling the fine, to be quite frank. I mean, that's my observation. That may not be correct, but I think that's hitting someplace around the truth on it. Though I do think that there is some deterrent value in doing this. But I also think, quite frankly, if a flashing light is good, then as the one person that testified online, that they double fines. I mean, I think all of us see the double fines, and it clicks up in your brain there very quickly, and your adding machine goes to work, and also has a deterrent factor. I also know it costs DOT to do that, so there's not a free lunch.
Just looks to me like people in Anchorage speed in school zones more. Is that correct, Senator French?
We love our children more than many other cities do.
We saw that the other day on the bus.
Right. Well, the numbers say that anyhow, but is there any further discussion? The chairman doesn't have any reason that he would carry the bill over, depending on the will of the committee. Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, I'll make a motion to move Senate Bill 109 from committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing none, this bill is moved on to the next committee. Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for your consideration.
Let's take a 5-minute break. Call the meeting back to order. Senator Terry will be back in just 1 second. We've got set up for the next bill we're going to hear. Will be Senate Bill 83. We know it's a governor's bill. Who's going to present for us this morning? If you'll get set up, as soon as Senator Terry gets back in the room, we'll be ready for you to proceed. So he'll be here in just 1 second.
Just FYI.
Oh, the amendment. Are we waiting for Senator Terry or are we going to be set? Okay.
Which one are we hearing first, Mr. Chairman? Yep. Which bill are we hearing first?
We're going to look at 83 first.
We have time tomorrow.
Right. We have scheduled for tomorrow bills previously heard indicating that we will not get through these two bills today, and so we have dedicated today and tomorrow to hear these bills. So if anybody gets uncomfortable about time, it's the practice of this committee to get bills previously heard are scheduled so that we can utilize our Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday sequence to the greatest efficiency for the members and as well as people who come to testify before the committee. Okay, if you folks will put yourself on the record, we'll be eager to hear your introduction to this bill this morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Stacy Crayley, and I'm a senior assistant attorney general with the Department of Law. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about Senate Bill 83. Senate Bill 83 includes several distinct provisions relating to child protection systems, each constituting a step toward making Alaskans' children safer, healthier, and more secure without unreasonably expanding governmental powers. This proposal amends Alaska Statute 2523-180 to permit parents to relinquish their parental rights to a child while retaining certain privileges, such as ongoing communication or visitation with the child. This proposed amendment is in response to a recent Alaska Supreme Court decision holding that current law prohibits a parent from retaining any rights or privileges in a relinquishment. In some cases, ongoing contact with the parent is in the child's best interest, particularly in cases involving adoption by relatives or family acquaintances. This proposal also adds language to Alaska Statute 4323-005 to allow children who are placed temporarily by the Department of Health and Social Services outside of the state in out-of-state treatment facilities, for example, to maintain to maintain eligibility for permanent fund dividends. Some children require long-term treatment of a nature that is currently unavailable in the state of Alaska. Such children are at risk of losing their permanent fund dividend eligibility if they remain out of state for more than a year and are unable to return to the state to meet PFD eligibility requirements. The department feels that these Alaskan children should not lose the privilege of a PFD as a result of being placed temporarily in an out-of-state treatment facility. Senate Bill 83 also adds language to Alaska Statute 4710-020 to clarify that the court may issue any orders necessary to aid the Department of Health and Social Services in its investigation of an allegation of child abuse or neglect. It is important to note that orders to aid the Department of Health and Social Services are not prohibited by existing law. However, the proposed clarification would resolve any ambiguity regarding the ability of judges to issue such orders across the state through various jurisdictions. A new subsection is also added to 4710-020, which clarifies that the department is not required to obtain authorization from the court to conduct an investigation of a protective services report, also known as a report of harm, or to file a petition with the court. Existing federal law requires the testimony of a qualified expert in order, for the court to authorize an out-of-home placement of or termination of a parental rights to an Indian child. This proposal adds a new section to Alaska Statute 4710-145 that permits the courts to conclude as a matter of law that the testimony of a qualified expert would support a finding that placing a child with a parent who cannot be located or is absent would place the child at a substantial risk of harm. Finally, this bill amends the definition of the term mental health professional in Alaska Statute 4730-915 for purposes of child in need of aid and juvenile delinquency proceedings. In order to authorize placement of a child in a secure residential psychiatric treatment facility, the court must hear the evidence of a mental health professional. The current definition excludes professionals who may be licensed to practice in states other than the state of Alaska. The testimony of such professional is often critical in cases involving Alaska children who are already placed in out-of-state facilities. Expansion of the existing definition is necessary to ensure that Alaska children who are placed outside of the state receive the psychiatric treatment that they need. That basically covers the substance of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Oh, I'm sorry. We did. Finally, the department is offering an amendment to this bill, to sections 5 and 9 of the bill, which would effectively amend AS 4710080, subparagraph L, and it would directly affect China Rule 17.2. This amendment would require the court to rule on whether the department has made reasonable efforts towards permanency for a child. This court ruling is required for the department to receive federal funding for foster care, and the purpose of the amendment is the federal government made a change to the Code of Federal Regulations after we amended 080, and the federal government requires the department to make these reasonable, these permanency findings, and there's not an analogous state requirement, and there's some confusion with the court system on whether or not they are obligated to make such a finding, and we need the finding to get federal funds.
That's a suggested
amendment.
Amendment to this bill as presented today. Do you have that in writing?
Yes.
No, it's in version G.
We have it in the file.
I have a proposed amendment here. I don't know if it's already
got it right here.
It's 24G/1.
Right.
And that's a proposed amendment.
But we're looking at our version that we are considering is backslash alpha. And this amendment is 24G-1. Okay. Questions? Senator Terrio?
So go over again the total population that we're talking about here. Is it kids, you use the word juvenile, child in need of aid, treatment, what population, or is a mix of all of those?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, there's two different provisions within this bill that would address both children who are in state custody, both under the Office of Children's Services and the Division of Juvenile Justice. And those two provisions in the bill deal with the permanent fund dividend, which would allow either of those populations to be eligible for permanent fund dividend, and also the amendment to the definition for mental health professional. And there's analogous provisions for juvenile justice and for children's services for placement in secure facilities, and the definition spans both of those populations.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if we have a child that is incarcerated and out of state, we're treating them the same way for dividend purposes as a child that's just in state custody for some other reason but out for treatment of a mental condition. I'm just wondering, for incarcerated felons, they lost their dividend, but we've put a system into place so the state system applies for them on their behalf, collects that money for restitution, things of that nature. Are we talking about?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, all this would deal with would be for those children who are placed in secure residential psychiatric treatment facilities for treatment purposes, and they would not be incarcerated as you're thinking of that term. I mean, they'd be in a secure setting, but it would be for treatment, not for
incarceration for a bad act.
For a penalty, no.
Thank you.
Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the PFD, Senator Terrio mentioned restitution. What are the scenarios of where the PFD goes?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, the permanent fund dividend, when a child is in the custody of the state of Alaska, we apply for a permanent fund dividend on their behalf, and the dividend goes into a trust account. And the Office of Children's Services, Department of Health and Social Services, maintains that trust account. And it stays, and each year that they're in our custody, we reapply. And so when they, at some point when custody is released or they age out, then their trust amount is released to either their legal guardian, their adoptive parent, their parents, and or to them if they've aged out. in different circumstances arise during the course of a proceeding where it may be advisable to request permission to use the permanent fund dividend, and it may be for a child who's in custody who maybe had a minor criminal infraction and had to pay restitution, at which point we on behalf of the social workers, the Department of Law, would file a motion with the court to release a certain portion of that trust fund to pay for restitution in order to make victims whole in those circumstances. But generally, the money is put in a trust fund and it sits there not to be disturbed until the department no longer has custody.
Thank you.
Further questions? Senator French?
Thank you. Going up to the first idea behind the bill, which is to allow some parents to retain the ability to communicate with their children after their rights have been terminated, what was the Supreme Court decision, our state Supreme Court decision, that sort of undid that?
Through the chair, Senator French, the case was in the matter of Keith M.W. 79 P. 3rd 623 Alaska 2003.
And what happened there? I mean, just tell me a little bit about why the Supreme Court reached that decision.
Again, through the chair, Senator French, I haven't read the case in a bit, but the general premise was that there, if you read the language of Alaska statutes under Title 25 and also under Title 47, 10 in the child in need of aid cases, that there is no, the language is unequivocal, that a relinquishment, there is no mechanism within this current statutory framework for a relinquishment to contain any sort of residual privileges or rights to a parent who is relinquishing. And so basically it would be what I would characterize as a stipulated termination. You just wouldn't have to go through a trial. And the court found in that case that the lack of statutory framework to allow for residual privileges to be offered to a parent in exchange for a relinquishment or in lieu of a termination did not exist. And so there could be no residual rights or privileges in a relinquishment document that you present to a parent to sign.
I may. A relinquishment is when a parent voluntarily gives up his or her parental rights. A termination is when that same effect is achieved through positive action by the department. Were there different rules? That is, could you terminate someone's parental rights and still allow communication?
Through the chair, Senator French, historically, prior to this decision, historically, the Department of Law and the Office of Children's Services have looked at them at the two different processes exactly as you explained them. Is you know, the relinquishment is a voluntary relinquishment of parental rights, whereas the termination usually occurs after a contested court hearing. What had been done historically is that the Department of Law and the Office of Children's Services had in lieu of termination, of going through the expense and the effort, had offered to parents a relinquishment of their parental rights, and within that relinquishment there were a number of residual privileges and those sorts of things, contact, you know, send a birthday card, get pictures, you know, that sort of thing. And in a lot of these cases, they were done in those instances where, you know, a grandparent was adopting or an aunt or uncle was adopting, so it would make sense to have these sorts of contact within that. And then when this decision came out, we were informed that we could no longer do that. And the relinquishment with the conditions is an effort to, you know, allow a parent to make a very difficult decision easier in within the best interest of their child and still allow for contact as long as, you know, and the contact was not unequivocal. It was still based upon best interest findings, and the foster adopt parents could regulate it, and if the parents weren't appropriate, the visitation wouldn't take place and that sort of thing. So it wasn't unequivocal contact, but it allowed for the parents to make very difficult decisions a little bit easier rather than go through a contested hearing.
When you terminate someone's parental rights, do you allow for communication after that termination, or is it sort of an iron door that's gone shut?
Through the chair, it's an iron door, and that was kind of the option, you know, that the termination would be a complete and an iron door. There would be no access. I mean, in some instances, of course, that may not happen because foster adopt parents may have relationships or that sort of thing, but that was the premise. It was a final determination. There would be no future contact or access to the child, whereas the relinquishment had the option.
So, if I may, Mr. Chairman, in the real world of negotiating cases of moving the huge caseloads that your attorneys have out of their offices, you can offer relinquishment with some conditions and some communications as sort of a carrot to avoid the, you know, difficult, time-consuming, and contentious termination proceeding.
Through the chair again, that's correct.
But yet the foster adopt people have the option of allowing continued contact if they choose, or they can slam the door shut at any time they want to?
Chairman Seekins, with respect to a termination, I think a foster adopt parent would always have that discretion, whether it be a relinquishment or a termination.
I'm talking about termination.
Or termination. They would have that. They would have the ability to make decisions on their children based upon their best interests.
Senator Huggins?
I'm sorry, is it Traley? Mrs.
Traley.
Traley, yes. I think it's fair to say that Health and Social Services has got some degree of visibility over this sort of thing in child and state handling of children. My bottom line question is this part, big part, small part of a larger strategy of evolving the organization, enhancing the image, and enhancing the effectiveness of what you're doing? Said another way, is this part of a number of events that you're going to bring before this committee and others to modify how you do business?
Well, through the chair, Senator Huggins, I'll answer from my perspective, and then Ms. Kanai can put in her spiel. But this bill in particular are what I would characterize as technical amendments to current statute that have, over the course of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of court cases, we've discovered there's, you know, a little hitch or a little giddy up here or there that needs to be fixed. So from the Department of Law's perspective, these amendments allow us to efficiently and effectively litigate these cases. That doesn't negate the fact, and I'm sure you're aware, there's a number of bills that are out there that the department and the governor are proposing with respect to the Office of Children's Services, but this particular bill will help the Department of Law more so than the Office of Children's Services do their job and do it effectively and efficiently. Then more, it doesn't necessarily affect as much the day-to-day management and administration of the Office of Children's
Services. So it's a technical fix and not part of the evolutionary process of the organization.
I see this more as tools to assist the Department of Law in managing their caseloads.
Thank you.
And also to be able to collect federal funds where they would be due.
Correct.
Okay. Let's consider the amendment for a moment. The amendment is before us, has been advanced to us. It is a long amendment. The chair will consider the amendment. And the intent here would be to ask that staff go back to the drafters, incorporate the amendment so that the next time we look at the bill we could see the entire text of what we're looking at rather than having two different pieces of paper. Even though it's not complicated, it helps in the total context of what we're looking at. Senator Huggins?
Mr. Chair, to make sure I understand, we're talking about 24-1, right?
Correct.
Yeah. I would move the 24-1 amendment be adopted for staff rewrite for finalization for consideration of the committee.
Okay, amendment number one would be 24-1. Is there objection to incorporating the amendment, Senator French?
Well, just more along the lines of discussion, Mr. Chairman. I'll object just for the discussion. Could you just re-synopsize this amendment for me, please? I was making notes on something else, and I might have missed your explanation of what this amendment does.
Through the chair, Senator French. Currently, the department under 4710.080, the court is required to make specific findings in different types of hearings in child and youth aid proceedings. And through the court improvement project, recently it was discovered that there was an omission of a specific finding that the federal government requires for 4E funding, foster care funding. And specifically, that omission was after 080 was amended a few years ago. The federal government came out with a new federal regulation that required the state to make what are called reasonable efforts to achieve the permanent plan for the child. And basically, what that means is that under the state and federal law, if you take a child into custody at 12 months, you need to go back into court and have what's called a permanency hearing. And the permanency hearing is a process where the department provides a report to the court and the parties all discuss what the permanency plan is. And permanency can be adoption, foster care, return to home, emancipation, that sort of thing. And the federal government has required, for purposes of getting this 4E funding, that the court make a specific judicial finding that the department has made reasonable efforts to finalize the permanency plan for the child from the time, you know, it's been in custody or since the last permanency hearing. And currently we have no statutory requirement that the judge make such a finding. And there was some discussion at the court improvement project that absent the specific statutory requirement that judges were uncomfortable making such a finding. And so the amendment proposes to make that a required finding. Whether they say we have or we haven't is what we need. But this would make it a legislative requirement that the finding be made so that we can continue to receive our foster care money under Title 40.
Senator French.
I assume you won't get the funding if they don't make the finding. That is, if they find against you.
That's correct.
Well,
go ahead.
Through the chair, for the record, I'm Marcy Kanai, Deputy Commissioner of the Office of Children's Services. What the finding is irrelevant here. It's just that we need a finding of reasonable efforts.
Oh, right.
So, for example,
so I misunderstood.
If we have not made reasonable efforts, we still get our federal funding. But basically what the feds are saying is that the court needs to make the determination.
There needs to be a check mark in order to get the money.
The mysteries of the federal government are constantly being revealed to me, and this is yet another one, I guess.
Well, it's kind of a check and balance, I think. What basically the feds are trying to do is force good practice. And good practice is if a child has been in care for 12 months, you know, we need to show that we've made reasonable efforts toward helping to effect a permanency plan for the child. If we haven't, you know, that could jeopardize our federal funding, but it could be that we haven't for a variety of reasons. So the main thing is that the court make the finding.
Right.
It's forcing the court to direct its attention to this issue.
Yes.
I see. And that's the thrust and the sum of this three-page amendment.
Yes.
Okay. Other questions on the amendment? Do you still maintain your objection, Senator French?
I'll remove my objection.
Without objection, amendment number one is incorporated into the document, and we will ask that we have it a completely redrafted single document. Further questions on this particular bill? Ladies, I appreciate it. We're going to carry this bill over. We want to just get an opportunity for the next bill to get an introduction for discussion purposes so that we know how to continue tomorrow. And we will be bringing this hopefully back up tomorrow. So if I could, we'll move on to Senate bill. Or we have do some public testimony. I do have Helen Alexander. Helen, are you still online? Anchorage. Don't hear her online. Do have Marcy Schmidt online from Matsu on 83. Marcy, are you online?
Yes, sir, I am online.
And you indicated that you wanted to testify on this bill?
Actually, I was more interested in Senate Bill 84. I will say that I'm happy that the department wants to consider what I would call an open adoption. On HB 83, the first section there, because that's what the language reads to me. I know I'm a layperson in this subject, and I'm just looking forward to both bill passages in the hopes that what the legislature passes, the department will do.
And I also thank you very much. Any questions? Well, Scott Calder is online, I think, from the Fairbanks LIO. Scott, did you want to testify on 83 before we move on?
Yes. Good morning, Senator Seekins. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you fine, sir.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm also interested in SB 84, but just a few quick things on SB 83. First of all, this amendment that you're talking about, even though we haven't seen it here yet, sounds like a good thing. And it's not a small thing to require that a court find that the department has made reasonable efforts to do things rather than simply having the department say that it's making reasonable efforts. That is a major thing, so I'm looking forward to that being an excellent amendment. Mr. Chairman, also in Section 1, I'm a little concerned about the use of the word privilege, but I don't want to quibble about that too much. Section 4 on page 3, I'm not in favor of this new subsection. It seems to me that it would be appropriate for the court to authorize the department in conducting an investigation. To the extent that there might be a search or a seizure of a child, a family member, some property, and so on, I really would like to see the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution preserved and upheld, and not see that this statutory change would go into effect. It seems to me that they should have some burden and some court authorization to conduct an investigation, as I say, if it involves a search of a child. In Section 5 on line 10, and I'm dealing with the version A, so I don't know if you have a different document there, but talks about after a reasonable search for the parent, guardian, or custodian has been conducted. I would like to see that say a diligent search or something to indicate that really every effort has been made or to qualify what a reasonable search is, rather than just assuming that if somebody says it's reasonable, then it is reasonable. I will look forward to seeing that amendment, and hopefully I might be able to comment on this bill tomorrow, if that's possible, and that concludes my testimony for today. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator French?
Thank you. A question, Mr. Calder.
Yes, sir.
Could you go back to Section 4, page 3, lines 2 through 6? Could you explain what the Fourth Amendment implications are of the department getting the authorization? This section, the way I read it, says that the department doesn't have to get an authorization from a court before it conducts an investigation or files a petition. Could you explain what your Fourth Amendment, can you just explain to me what your Fourth Amendment concerns are regarding that?
Yes, sir, and thank you for that question. It's my belief and understanding that the department could say that in conducting an investigation or a report of child abuse or neglect, that it might want to, for example, interview the child or conduct some type of an action to or upon the child of a person. And it seems to me that would be the point where you would want the court to say that they could do that. If you're searching or seizing a person or papers, effects, at that point, then I think that it would be good to have a court order. Now, I can easily understand or envision or imagine that there could be activities involved with an investigation that would not amount to that, and so that's why I think some qualifying language would be good to indicate, you know, if it's just a phone call to somebody at a school or maybe talking to a mandated reporter about a report of harm, something like that, it seems to me that it would be an unnecessary burden on the department to have to get a court order simply to make a phone call. But if it's to the point where the child is impacted by the state agents involved in an investigation, then I would think that it would be the proper respect to the child and the family of the child that there be some judicial oversight involved and some judicial process involved at that point. I hope that clarifies my point on that.
Thank you.
Your concern is about the extent of the investigation.
Yes, sir. Not just the fact of an investigation, but if the investigation, if what the department says it's doing in conducting an investigation would amount to, you know, more than just a phone call or, you know, simply checking into some, you know, small matter of information. If, you know, if they're putting the child in a room and talking to them about, you know, what goes on at home and that sort of thing, I would think that that would be a search or a seizure that ought to involve, in the interest of all Alaskans, you know, some greater scrutiny with regard to the Fourth Amendment.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? I think that's all the indicated people that I have on 83 this morning. With that in mind, and looking at the time, we do, Senator Terrell?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, this is Linda Wilson with the Public Defender Agency. I did have some comments. I signed up. I don't know whether I was on the list.
Oh, I see that you did. I looked at it. Said it indicated to me that there were questions. That if there were questions, Linda.
Oh no, sorry, I had testified.
Okay, fine. Go ahead. We're short on time. We have a special joint session this morning. But if you can give us something succinct, we're going to continue with this again tomorrow.
Sure, I'm happy to wait till tomorrow. I'm following the next bill as well. So if you would rather put me off tomorrow, that'd be just fine.
Why don't we do that? Because we do have a joint session at 10:45 today, and members need to get ready for that and also attend to other matters on their calendar as well. So if you don't mind, we'll hold you over until tomorrow. With that in mind, we do have an amended version to continue on with tomorrow. I think we'll just hold over 84 and introduce that tomorrow as well. Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, just a technical thing on Senate Bill 83 up on the floor of the title. Child in need should be hyphenated, I believe. If you're talking about the statutes, it's hyphenated. If you're talking about court rules, it's not. So if staff would just check with the drafter on that.
Okay.
A good example is on the next bill, 84, the title, lines 4 and 5, has it both ways. Again, if it's in the statute, it's happening, if it's court rules, it's not.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification, Senator Terrio, because I didn't know that.
I think that's right, so that's why I'm going to ask the drafter.
Is there anything else that we need a pertinent question that we need a burning question on this bill this morning? Seeing none, for the matter of to allow members to get ready for the joint session, we're going to adjourn the meeting.